Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It's in the Scottish Government's interest not just to protect, obviously, public services, but also to show further divergence from the rest of the UK.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
The other factor playing into all this is Brexit. Neither political party will even contemplate relaxing EU migration. This is the elephant in the room, isn't it?
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to today's programme. So in a moment, we're going to take a deep dive into the future of the NHS. Joining us from the IPPR and the IEA, two leading kind of thinkers on this issue. The industrial action, the strikes are building into a crescendo tomorrow. So we'll, you know, have a few questions about what to do over pay, but then also longer term, what is the big conversation about solving this thing that is the NHS?
Yeah, really interesting to take that deep dive into the future of the NHS once we get the strikes resolved, and it doesn't look like they're going to be resolved anytime soon. But once that is done, how do we fix those problems, those long-standing problems of the NHS? A really interesting conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Having said that, there is an urgent problem, really, for Rishi Sunak. He may want to restore growth, but only look at the IMF forecast for Britain today, and you realise how big a task it really is. So the IMF has downgraded growth for Britain. It's actually going to be the only country in the G7 that's going to shrink this year.
Yeah, pretty gloomy numbers from the IMF, and they've really downgraded their forecast from the last one, which was just 3 months ago. They've really say the UK is going to do much worse this year than they were expecting. And fascinating bit of research from Bloomberg Economics on Brexit. Now, we're going to be speaking in a second to Dan Hansen from Bloomberg Economics about how they put this figure on the cost of Brexit. The BE reckon it's costing the UK £100 billion a year in lost output, 4% of GDP, a pretty stark number.
Yeah, it's an eye-catching figure, isn't it? Also, just in terms of the politics and the nitty-gritty, so there's an urgent question that Rachel Reeves is going to put to the Chancellor at lunchtime today to try to get a statement on this IMF economic forecast. And then this afternoon, you've got Jeremy Hunt speaking to the 1922 Committee of Tory backbenchers. That's not till 4:30, but of course, he was here in the Bloomberg building on Friday giving his kind of economic outlook. Mm. So I'm sure he'll get questions from those MPs on, you know, he didn't make any big policy announcements. He sort of talked about it being a framework.
The framework, yeah. the four E's laid out in the...
Don't ask me what the four E's are.
You've forgotten them.
I have forgotten them. I'm, you know,
hazard a guess at some of them, but probably not all of them.
Education, employment. Anyway, never mind. Let's not talk about that. Let's bring you, first of all, we spoke this morning to Anand Menon, who's the director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe. So we put that big number to him, the cost of Brexit to Britain year on year. We asked him how easy it is to put a figure on how much Brexit has cost Britain.
Well, with great difficulty, admittedly, and with all due respect to Bloomberg Economics, I'm slightly leery about trying to put an exact figure on this. But if you combine the aggregate numbers that show that relative to other advanced economies, UK trade hasn't bounced back from the pandemic as much as other major economies, plus the proliferation of anecdotal stories from businesses, plus good modelling evidence from economists showing that there is a link, for instance, between Brexit and a degree of inflation in things like food prices. And I think it's very, very hard to avoid the fact that the vast majority of professional economists are saying that their work points towards a Brexit impact, albeit that those same economists might disagree on what precisely the scale of that impact is.
It does seem like that some progress is being made on one of the stickiest issues the UK and the EU have been dealing with their relationship, the Northern Ireland Protocol. Our sources reporting that they are they're said to say that a deal on many of parts of that is within sight. Are you hopeful that a resolution is imminent?
Not particularly, I have to say. I mean, we've been here before. There have been a number of times while this row over the protocol has dragged on when we've been told we're within touching distance of a deal. And the problem here is, even though some progress has been made on parts of this, is there are real substantive differences between the two sides. And what we don't know at the moment is, for instance, the British government had insisted that they wanted the protocol rewritten. They wanted the role of the European Court of Justice taken out of it. The EU had maintained they won't rewrite the protocol, and the European Court of Justice has to have a role in Northern Ireland. And I'm still rather sceptical as to whether or not that can be fudged. But we'll wait and see. I very much hope that there's an agreement. But at the moment, all we're hearing is positive mood music. And I think we're going to have to wait, because as ever, the devil is going to be in the detail.
Well, that was Anand Menon, Director of UK in a Changing Europe. Well, now we can speak to Dan Hansen from Bloomberg Economics. He put together our research on the cost of Brexit. It is exactly 3 years to the day since the UK left the European Union. Dan, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg UK Politics. Now, tell us how you got to this £100 billion figure, this £100 billion cost to the UK of leaving the EU.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me. So the way we put it together was to look at we did a counterfactual exercise. So what would the UK, how might you have expected the UK economy to have performed had its relationship with the rest of the G7 held since the referendum? And so you construct this counterfactual, you look at what actually has happened to GDP, and you look at the gap between the two. And what we find is that the gap between the two, this sort of counterfactual GDP, counterfactual path of the UK and actual UK GDP, was about 4% in the third quarter of 2022, which is the last bit of GDP data that we have. And one thing I'd say is that through the passage of time, the gap has widened. They actually widened quite significantly in the fourth quarter. If you look at the estimate we have for the third quarter, if you look at the estimate you have for the second quarter, it was about 3%. And that, obviously, that widening reflected the fact that the rest of the G7 didn't do too badly in the third quarter, but the UK economy contracted. So the gap widened. I mean, just to go to the clip you played, I mean, I think, of course, there's a high degree of uncertainty about all these things. I mean, I don't think anyone's debating that. But I think what is clear, at least to us, is however you cut it with these exercises, the impact on the UK from Brexit appears to be pretty large, and it appears to have happened far faster than any forecasters, I should say, appear to have factored into their forecasts. So most forecasters are expecting this slow burn impact on the UK economy. And I've said this a number of times before. And actually what appears to have happened is you've had this rupture from the single market, and that has actually come through in the data far, far quicker. So I think that's probably the more important takeaway from this, rather than focusing solely on the numbers.
Okay. Dan, look, people who are pro-Brexit will throw turnips at this, though, and say it's a counterfactual, as you point out, and therefore it's just, you know, impossible to say with certainty. But I suppose are we going to keep rerunning this debate again and again? Because the issue is, we had Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, here in the Bloomberg offices just on Friday, not admitting to any Brexit impact, effectively, kind of denying that this is reality, I would argue.
Yeah, that's right. But I think the burden of proof, you know, it's on those who are claiming that there hasn't been any impact. So we didn't just look at GDP. We've looked at trade. We've looked at investment. We've also looked at migration. That's all part of this same note. And the evidence is pretty clear that there is an impact. Now, as I say, you know, the scale of it is very uncertain. There's no, you can come on and be sort of absolutely clear about a number, but what I struggle with is where there's been a positive impact in the data, where it's very clear that since the referendum or since leaving the single market, since the point 3 years ago, where in the data is that positive spin? Now, admittedly, there have been a few things happening in the interim. We've had a pandemic, in the midst of an energy crisis, and I understand the government's focus has been shifted away from Brexit, and that might be one reason to think that as things calm down, hopefully, fingers crossed, and there's a little bit more calm, the government can turn its focus towards making the most of Brexit. But it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a real challenge to make it work.
Okay, so the onus is on them to prove it. Dan, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting to have you on. Our UK senior economist, Dan Hansen.
Well, let's get another new for you now. Nathalie Loiseau is former French Europe minister, now member of the European Parliament. She says that relations have been pretty tricky over the past 3 years.
Well, obviously, there's a change in tone, which is welcome. But as you well know, there was a question of trust. After negotiating, agreeing on different agreements, and even ratifying them on both sides of the channel, the fact that the previous government in London was denying its commitment created a huge crisis around trust. I do hope that now these difficulties can be overcome, and that with all the flexibilities that are included in the Northern Ireland Protocol, we can find an agreed solution, and certainly not a unilateral one, and move forward.
Will a deal on this particular issue open the path for a deeper friendship, perhaps a wider trade deal between the UK and the EU?
Well, you know, the relation between the EU and the UK is exactly the one which was chosen by the British government. There was Brexit, this is undeniable, but the type of Brexit which was chosen by Boris Johnson at the time, being outside of the single market, outside of the customs union, was his own choice. Never ever did the European Union say you have to remain that distant. What is going to happen in the future is again in the hands of the UK authorities. If they want better relations or closer relations, we are always ready, considering that with more relations come more I wouldn't say alignment, but more closeness in decision-making.
Up next, beyond the many strikes, how do we fix the problems of the NHS? We're going to get two different views from two think tanks. This is Bloomberg UK Politics.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com. stiefelnicholas.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIEFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Ewan Potts. This is your daily guide to the corridors of power.
So nurses, junior doctors, paramedics, physiotherapists, there is a long list of NHS workers currently taking industrial action over pay. But the problems in the health service, of course, extend well beyond unhappy staff. There are more than 7 million people on waiting lists, emergency care targets being missed by a wide margin, and deteriorating maternity care.
But when the strikes are eventually resolved, how do we move forward? Let's discuss this now with two think tank guests. Chris Thomas, head of the Commission on Health and Prosperity at the IPPR, and Matthew Lesh, head of public policy at the IEA. Now, before we look at some of the longer term issues, a quick thought from each of you on how we settle the strikes. Matthew, aren't we just going to have to throw a lot more money at this problem?
Well, I think the government, in a sense, is stuck between a rock and a hard place here, which is across the workforce, public and private sector, a lot of people are experiencing in real terms decline in incomes as we see this very high level of inflation. And if the government starts capitulating to one group in the public sector, then there'll be more demands in other parts. And there'll obviously be a very high cost, an immediate cost, an ongoing cost. So I'm not sure if the government can throw money at the problem if trade off that there has to be less money elsewhere in the NHS. I'm not sure that there are easy solutions to this. There might be some kind of arrangement where they can bring forward pay rises for next year, or potentially in the longer run deal with the question around pensions, where a lot of the ultimate salary for public sector workers goes into their pension pots, but they can't opt to see that today. And unfortunately, that means a lower pay today and a benefit in the future that they might want to exchange.
Yeah, okay. So that's the difficulty then, perhaps, in why the government has not managed to come to any kind of arrangement in the week so far. Chris, how much of the problems in the NHS are staff-related, pay and recruitment? How do we fix those problems?
Yeah, a huge amount of the problem is just the core capacity with 1 in 10 roles in the NHS vacant and projections that across health and adult social care that will be 1 million staff short by 2030. It's a really big problem. I think it's obviously a problem in terms of staffing services. So can people get into their general practitioner and see their GP in good time? Can they get emergency care when they need it? What's going on with kind of cancer through to dementia services? But we're also increasingly seeing that health is a big economic headwind. We've got record numbers out the labour market because of the long-term health condition. So it's also quite a big economic proposition. And so if we're thinking about kind of how do we bring industrial action to an end, what's the negotiation that gets there? There's an equation here, which is can we afford not to, given how much of an impact ill health is currently having on things like people's access to work and the economy as a whole?
Matthew, what do you make of the government's announcement this week of extra beds and ambulances?
Look, I think this is a pretty typical announcement in the government. We get a new workforce plan or emergency plan or 5 or 10 year plan for the NHS every 6 months or so. It doesn't seem like these things make much difference in the longer run. And it's the same story, I think, with the winter crisis. We are facing a winter crisis, and perhaps a particularly bad one, but a winter crisis of the NHS is nothing new or unique or special, and that it isn't something that's universal. I think a lot of other healthcare systems do manage to perform much better compared to the NHS. I think that's the conversation that needs to be had, which is why patients waiting days to be admitted, why are they lying in corridors, why are people screaming in pain in emergency rooms? And I think it's something more fundamental here than talking about funding year to year or a few more beds here or there. The NHS, of course, has more funding than ever before and 40% more funding in inflation-adjusted terms since 2010, and yet it's delivering poor outcomes. Its output is poor compared to a lot of other healthcare systems across Europe. And looking at different structures of healthcare is far more important than these kind of short-term rejigging of the decks on the chairs on the Titanic.
But Matthew, it is fair to say, though, that the NHS is pretty cheap, isn't it, by international standards? So although the outcomes, certainly at the moment, don't seem to be that great, it is a cheap form of healthcare, isn't it? We spend much less as a share of GDP than many other countries.
Well, I don't think that might have been the case previously, but it's not really the case anymore. If you look at the latest statistics in terms of where the UK spends in terms of health, it was previously around average, is now well above average. Certainly not anywhere near as high as the US, but the US is an outlier when it comes to health spending. The UK, by OECD standards, is in the top quarter of spending, and yet in the bottom quarter of outcomes. So it's not just about money in the end.
Chris, let me bring you in. I mean, the UK has an ageing population, to factor into this as well. Do we need to just pay more? Both Labour and Tory parties seem to be hinting at major reforms and, bringing the private sector in, whether it's, at source or sort of in, the back, via the back door of the NHS, I suppose. So how do you think that funding is going to be managed going forwards?
Yeah, it's a really pertinent question. So I think the idea that reform is needed in the NHS is absolutely right. I think, if we see people in the workforce not getting kind of a good work life and patients struggling to get access, then something has got to give. But I think the direction of that reform needs to be thought through quite carefully. I think what it doesn't mean is that bad ideas that have big opportunity costs in terms of kind of big shifts in the operating model of the NHS of founding principles suddenly become good ideas. It means that we need to think about what the demands specifically of the 21st century are, some of the things you mentioned, an aging population, the kind of things that innovation is making possible and the changes to the healthcare model that necessitates. And I think that gives rise to some of the better ideas that are out there at the moment. So one of those might be that we need to shift more care outside of a very hospital-led model into a much more community-led model where general practitioners are, where social carers, where community care providers are. That would, I think, go a long way to then breaking the gridlock that we see in hospitals. And that long-term thinking is really important. But we've got ourselves into a position, and I think the £1 billion announcement is indicative of this, where the government aren't allowing themselves any room for long-term thinking because the short-term crisis is now so acute.
Yeah, Chris, I want to point to that, really. Is there capacity for the government to be able to think about that? And I mean sort of either the stripe, you were 2 years away from a general election. Is there some format in which a big conversation around the NHS has to happen with all sides. For example, it's reminiscent of what has happened for certain healthcare issues in Ireland, where actually both parties have had to come together to find a solution. I mean, is that going to end up being necessary for the NHS?
Yeah, I mean, I think both parties have it within their scope to come forward with plans for how they get the NHS back on track. I mean, from a political point of view, it certainly makes sense when the public are asked what issues are going to define how they vote at the ballot box. Healthcare is if not the top issue, then very far away in the top two with the economy. And given the interactions between health and the economy, I think the party that comes up with the most appealing, sensible and implementable plan is the one that's going to get a lot of political capital off of that. I think, you know, that needs to be a plan probably based in doing some of the short-term symptom relief. So what are the immediate things we can do to uplift capacity, space, to bring in some of the kind of most immediately ready innovation, and then to use that as leverage to start doing some of the long-term thinking. So for the next 10 years, how do we move towards that more community-led model of care? What do we do about prevention, something that austerity kind of wiped out in terms of a way of managing healthcare demand, managing costs? How do we get that going again? Those are the kind of particular items I think that will make a big difference.
I want to ask you both about what we can learn from elsewhere. International best practice. Matthew, you've written about the Australian system, haven't you? You say that there are much better health outcomes in Australia.
Well, I think that's indeed the case. If you look at comparison to the Australian system, which has some elements that are similar to the NHS in the sense of universal healthcare, insurance provision for everyone, no matter their wealth or their income. At the same time, there's a quite thriving private sector, privately insured market in Australia, where around 30 or 40% of people take responsibility for their own healthcare, and that reduces burdens on the public system. And there are also specific subsidies for that private health insurance in the Australian context. Not only is it not taxed in terms of VAT, but there's incentives in the income tax system to get a health insurance if you're a higher income earner. That's one alternative model. There's other alternative models. In Israel, you have choices between different effectively national insurers. So you can choose, do you want insurer A or insurer B that can provide you a better service? That creates some competition within the system. Elsewhere in Europe, you have very successful social insurance systems, particularly in the likes of the Nordic countries. That doesn't necessarily mean the government continues to deliver all healthcare. In fact, often the government isn't necessarily as involved with the provision of healthcare. They are involved in ensuring that everyone gets universal access to healthcare, but giving patients a lot more choice and ensuring a lot more underlying competition in the system. And the problem consistently, though, with the NHS in policy debates, though, is when you start talking about alternative systems, everyone says, we're trying to destroy the NHS, you're trying to ruin healthcare. And you get all these kind of scaremongering that comes around it. And I think we have to put that aside and have a more down-to-earth discussion about what are the realistic alternatives to the NHS? How is it functioning compared to other systems in respect to both ensuring access but also ensuring good outcomes and good quality care?
And Chris, just briefly, what else can we learn from abroad?
Yeah, look, I mean, there are lots of lessons, and I think, you know, there are, there's a funding lesson in terms of the UK having, over the last 10 years, spent $40 billion less on its NHS than if it had met comparable countries. There's staffing differences, both in terms of the model of how the workforce works, but also just the sheer capacity of it. But I think the kind of overarching point is that the NHS is an incredibly complicated system, and there are lots of things that will make a big difference. There are lots of opportunities for reform. And I think the ones that probably have the weakest evidence base in terms of would they make a difference and would they be worth the opportunity cost of pursuing them are the kind of big fundamental shifts to social insurance or to more competition. Things, to be honest, the UK's experimented with. And if we look at dentistry, social care models that embody a lot of that, it doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So I think we should be looking at kind of a broad range of actions that within the founding principles of the NHS can make a big difference in coming from a 20th century model to a 21st one.
Well, this may well be the foundation, of course, of the big debate when it comes to the next general election. We shall see. Thank you to both of you for joining us today. Chris Thomas is the head of the Commission on Health and Prosperity at the IPPR, and Matthew Lesh, head of public policy at the IAE. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, that's it from us today. This episode was produced by James Walcock, and Marie Fulhassane was on sound. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.